Chapter 10. Trust to Aladdin, and let him put the job through for me. Much better have your own fun with it, I retorted. But he shook his head, saying with a sigh as he turned away, colon, it's not fun to me, that's the worst of it. Aladdin, to whom I could not help repeating our talk, was amused and touched by his friend's thought. Heaven knows what will become of the scheme, if Paul doesn't live to carry it out. There are a lot of hungry Ambrose cousins who will make one gulp of his money, and never give a dollar to the work. Jove, it would be a fine thing, to have the carrying out of such a plan, but he'll do it yet, you'll see he'll do it yet, cried Ned, his old faith in his friend flaming up again through the wet blanket of fact. 2. Paul Ambrose did not die and leave his fortune to Aladdin, but the following summer he did something far more unexpected. He went abroad again and came back married. Now our busy fancy had never seen Paul married. Even Ned recognized the vague unlikelihood of such a metamorphosis. He'd stick at the parson's fee, not to mention the best man's scarf pin. And I should hate, Ned added sentimentally, to see the touch of a woman's hand desecrate the sublime ugliness of the ancestral home. Think of such a house made cozy. But when the news came, he would own neither to surprise nor to disappointment. Goodbye, poor Academy, I exclaimed, tossing over the bridegroom's 8-page rhapsody to Aladdin, who had received its duplicate by the same post. Now, why the deuce do you say that, he growled. I never saw such a beast as you are for imputing mean motives. To defend myself from this accusation, I put out my hand and recovered Paul's letter. Here, listen to this. Studying art in Paris when I met her, he vision and the faculty divine, but lacking the accomplishment, etc. A little ethereal profile, like one of Piero della Francesca's angels. Not rich, thank heaven, but not afraid of money and already enamored of my project for fertilizing my sterile millions. Well, why the deuce, Ned began again, as though I had convicted myself out of my friend's mouth, and I could only grumble obscurely. It's all too pat. He brushed aside my misgivings. Thank heaven, she can't paint, anyhow. And now that I think of it, Paul's just the kind of chap who ought to have a dozen children. Ah, then indeed. Goodbye, poor Academy, I croaked. The lady was lovely, of that there could be no doubt, and if Paul now for a time forgot the Academy, his doing so was but a vindication of his sex. Aladdin had only a glimpse of the returning couple before he was himself snatched up in one of the chariots of adventure that seemed perpetually waiting at his door. This time he was going to the Far East in the train of a special mission, and his head was humming with new hopes and ardors. But he had time for a last word with me about Ambrose. You'll see, he summed up hopefully as we parted. And what I was to see was, of course, the crowning pinnacle of the Academy lifting itself against the horizon of the immediate future. It was in the nature of things that I should, meanwhile, see less than formerly of the projector of that unrealized structure. Paul had a personal dread of society, but he wished to show his wife to the world, and I was not often a spectator on these occasions. Paul indeed, good fellow, tried to maintain the pretense of an unbroken intercourse, and to this end I was asked to dine now and then. But when I went I found guests of a new type, who, after dinner, talked of sport and stocks, while their host blinked at them silently through the smoke of his cheap cigars. The first innovation that struck me was a sudden improvement in the quality of the cigars. Was this Daisy's doing? Mrs. Ambrose was Daisy. It was hard to tell she produced her results so noiselessly. With her fair bent head and vague smile, she seemed to watch life flow by without, as yet, trusting anything of her own to its current. But she was watching, at any rate, and anything might come of that. Such modifications as she produced were as yet almost imperceptible to any but the trained observer. I saw that Paul wished her to be well dressed, but also that he suffered her to drive in a hired brougham, and to have her door opened by the raw-boned celt who had bumped down the dishes on his bachelor table. The drawing-room curtains were renewed, but this change served only to accentuate the enormities of the carpet, and perhaps discouraged Mrs. Ambrose from farther experiments. At any rate, the desecrating touch that Aladdin had affected to dread made no other inroads on the serried ugliness of the Ambrose interior. In the early summer, when Ned returned, the Ambroses had flown to Europe again, and the Academy was still on paper. "Well, what do you make of her?" the traveler asked, as we sat over our first dinner together. "Too many things and they don't hang together. Perhaps she's still in the chrysalis stage. Has Paul chucked the scheme altogether?" "No. He sent for me, and we had a talk about it, just before he sailed."
"And what impression did you get?"
"That he had waited to send for me till, just before he sailed."
"Oh, there you go again."
I offered no denial, and after a pause he asked Colin, "Did she ever talk to you about it?"
"Yes.
Once or twice in snatches."
"Well, she thinks it all too beautiful. She would like to see beauty put within the reach of everyone.
And the practical side, she says she doesn't understand business."
Aladdin rose with a shrug.
"Very likely you frightened her with your ugly sardonic grin. It's not my fault if my smile doesn't add to the sum total of beauty."
"Well," he said, ignoring me, "next winter we shall see."
But the next winter did not bring Ambrose back. A brief line, written in November from the Italian lakes, told me that he had rotten cough, and that the doctors were packing him off to Egypt. Would I see the architects for him, and explain to the trustees?
The Academy already had trustees, and all the rest of its official hierarchy.
And would they all excuse his not writing more than a word? He was really too groggy, but a little warm weather would set him up again, and he would certainly come home in the spring. He came home in the spring in the hold of the ship, with his widow several decks above. The funeral services were attended by all the officers of the Academy, and by two of the young fellows who had won the traveling scholarships, and who shed tears of genuine grief when their benefactor was committed to the grave. After that there was a pause of suspense, and then the newspapers announced that the late Paul Ambrose had left his entire estate to his widow. The board of the Academy dissolved like a summer cloud, and the secretary lighted his pipe for a year with the official paper of the stillborn institution. After a decent lapse of time I called at the house in 17th Street, and found a man attaching a real estate agent's sign to the window, and a van load of luggage backing away from the door. The caretaker told me that Mrs. Ambrose was sailing the next morning. Not long afterward I saw the library table with the helmeted knights standing before an auctioneer's door in University Plus. And I looked with a pang at the familiar ink stains, in which I had so often traced the geography of Paul's visionary world. Aladdin, who had picked up another job in the Orient, wrote me an elegiac letter on Paul's death, ending with, "And what about the Academy?" And for all answer I sent him a newspaper clipping recording the terms of the will, and another announcing the sale of the house, and Mrs. Ambrose's departure for Europe. Though Ned and I corresponded with tolerable regularity, I received no direct answer to this communication till about 18 months later, when he surprised me by a letter dated from Florence. It began, "Colin, though she tells me you have never understood her," and when I had reached that point I laid it down, and stared out of my office window at the chimney pots, and the dirty snow on the roof. "Ned Aladdin and Paul's wife," I murmured. And, incongruously enough, my next thought was, "Colin, I wish I'd bought the library table that day." The letter went on with waxing eloquence, "Colin, I could not stand the money, if it were not that, to her as well as to me, it represents the sacred opportunity of at last giving speech to his inarticulateness. Dot, oh, damn it, they're too glib," I muttered, dashing the letter down. Then,
Controlling my unreasoning resentment, I read on. Why you remember, old man, those words of his that he repeated to me 3 or 4 years ago. I've half a mind to leave my money in trust to Ned. Well, it has come to me in trust, as if in mysterious fulfillment of his thought. And, oh, dear chap, I dashed the letter down again and plunged into my work. 3. Won't you own yourself a beast, dear boy? Paladin asked me gently, one afternoon of the following spring. I had escaped for a 6 weeks holiday, and was lying outstretched beside him in a willow chair on the terrace of their villa above Florence. My eyes turned from the happy veil at our feet to the illuminated face beside me. A little way off, at the other end of the terrace, Mrs. Paladin was bending over a pot of carnations on the balustrade. Oh, cheerfully, I assented. You see, he continued, glowing, living here costs us next to nothing, and it was quite our idea, our founding that fourth scholarship in memory of Paul. I had already heard of the fourth scholarship, but I may have betrayed my surprise at the plural pronoun, for the blood rose under Ned's sensitive skin, and he said with an embarrassed laugh, she so completely makes me forget that it's not mine to. Well, the great thing is that you both think of it chiefly as his. Oh, chiefly altogether. I should be no more than a wretched parasite if I didn't live first of all for that. Mrs. Paladin had turned, and was advancing toward us with the slow step of leisurely enjoyment. The bud of her beauty had at last unfolded. Her vague enigmatical gaze had given way to the clear look of the woman whose hand is on the clue of life. She's not living for anything but her own happiness, I mused, and why in heaven's name should she? But Ned, my wife, Paladin continued, his eyes following mine, my wife feels it too, even more strongly. You know a woman's sensitiveness. She's there's nothing she wouldn't do for his memory, because in other ways. You understand, he added, lowering his tone as she drew near, that as soon as the child is born we mean to go home for good, and take up his work, Paul's work. Mrs. Paladin recovered slowly after the birth of her child. The return to America was deferred for 6 months, and then again for a whole year. I heard of the Paladins as established first at Biarritz, then in Rome. The second summer Ned wrote me a line from St. Moritz. He said the place agreed so well with his wife who was still delicate, that they were thinking of building a house there. A mere cleft in the rocks, to hide our happiness in, when it becomes too exuberant, and the rest of the letter, very properly, was filled with a rhapsody upon his little daughter. He spoke of her as Paula. The following year the Paladins reappeared in New York, and I heard with surprise that they had taken the Brereton house for the winter. Well, why not? I argued with myself. After all, the money is hers. As far as I know, the will didn't even hint at a restriction. Why should I expect a pretty woman with two children, for now there was an heir, spend her fortune on a visionary scheme that its originator hadn't the heart to carry out? Yes, cried the devil's advocate at Ned. My first impression of Paladin was that he had thickened all through. He was heavier, physically, with the ruddiness of good living, rather than of hard training. He spoke more deliberately, and had less frequent bursts of subversive enthusiasm. Well, he was a father, a householder, yes, and a capitalist now. It was fitting that his manner should show a sense of these responsibilities. As for Mrs. Paladin, it was evident that the only responsibilities she was conscious of were those of the handsome woman and the accomplished hostess. She was handsomer than ever, with her two babies at her knee, perfect mother as she was perfect wife. Poor Paul! I wonder if he ever dreamed what a flower was hidden in the folded bud? Not long after their arrival, I dined alone with the Paladins, and lingered on to smoke with Ned, while his wife went alone to the opera. He seemed dull, and out of sorts, and complained of a twinge of gout. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.